Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. This is going to be a pretty big day. A big day on a week of many big days. We've got tons coming for you. Not only was the text of the whistleblower complaint finally made public, I've got some excerpts from that. What can we learn from it? How horrified should we be following it? But we also have the media sort of scrambling to understand what their role is in this story as it unfolds. And I'm talking about both Fox News, but also outlets like the New York Times. I've got some issues with both of them, actually. We've got Michael Brooks. He's going to be joining the show to talk about both impeachment, but also the state of the Democratic primary with Biden and Warren still currently leading Bernie. What should Bernie do if he wants to take first place? We're going to talk a little bit of strategy. I've got the legendary Tom Hartman who's going to be joining me later on the show to talk about his upcoming book on the Supreme Court. It's out of control power and what might be done through reforms to finally change it. And if there's time, important international stories we're going to be covering at the close of the show in Meanwhile In. But with that, there's just too much. So let's jump right into the big news of the morning. The whistleblower complaint is now available and there is a lot to it. Nothing fundamentally changes from what we've learned earlier this week with the transcript of the call and all that. But there are some things that we need to get clear. And so I'm going to jump into a few sections of this. It's only 5 or 6 pages, so I would definitely advise that you go and read it yourself. But let's start off. And again, this is from the whistleblower who started this entire thing. The first section, in the course of my official duties, I have received information from multiple US government officials that the president of the United States is using the power of his office to solicit interference from a foreign country in the 2020 US elections. This interference includes, among other things, pressuring a foreign country to investigate one of the president's main domestic political rivals. The president's personal lawyer, Mr. Rudolph Giuliani, is a central figure in this effort. Attorney General Barr appears to be involved as well. So the beginning of that is just basically, you know, what we know about the scandal. It's why it's a scandal in the first place. But while we already knew that Rudy Giuliani was an important part of this, and an important part in clearly differentiating what was going on from normal diplomacy and into the area of working for the personal political benefit of the president, that's why his personal lawyer is doing it. The fact that Attorney General Barr is involved in that, that is very bad news, not least of which for Attorney General Barr. So, quick note, the only reason he's the attorney general, the only qualification, the only reason he was chosen in the first place is because he made clear in a letter that he made available so that Trump would see it, that he does not believe that the president falls under the purview of the law. That's it. It's as simple as that. There's nothing else, nothing ideological. He was set to protect, he was put there to protect the president and to at least allegedly get involved in his criminal actions himself, which is probably why headlines like this are coming out. Justice Department rejected investigation of Trump phone call just weeks after it began examining the matter. So the complaint is launched at the next level. It is considered to be credible, so the Justice Department has to investigate it. They conducted no investigations and they quashed it as fast as they can. And consider the conflict of interest there, that the Justice Department under William Barr squashes an investigation into a scandal that implicates William Barr in it. I mean, that is on some of the headlines, as you can see, but not nearly enough of them. This goes to the top of the Justice Department as well as to the White House as well. So how wide is this? How much did people in the White House know about this? That is in the next section. The White House officials who told me this information were deeply disturbed by what had transpired in the phone call. They told me that there was already a quote discussion ongoing with White House lawyers about how to treat the call because of the likelihood in the officials' retelling that they had witnessed the president abuse his office for personal gain. So it is all well and good for the White House to put out talking points now saying everything he did was by the book, everything was fine. But we now know that at the time they were thinking this looks really bad. We really need to come up with something to stop this from becoming politically damaging to the president. And even more importantly, one of the biggest takeaways from this, they did find something to try to hide it. Take a look at this. In the days following the phone call, I learned from multiple US officials that senior White House officials had intervened to quote lock down all records of the phone call, especially the official word for word transcript of the call that was produced as is customary by the White House Situation Room. This set of actions underscored to me that White House officials understood the gravity of what had transpired in the call. So there, first of all, there is apparently a word for word transcript somewhere. Hidden somewhere, I don't know at this point. But they knew that this was bad, so bad that they needed to control access to this information. So White House officials told the whistleblower that they were directed by White House lawyers to remove the electronic transcript from the computer system in which such transcripts are typically stored for coordination, finalization, and distribution to cabinet level officials. So normally there is a process for this and it is stored somewhere. It's not publicly available or anything like that, but it's not too hidden away, not too secured. In this case, things were different. Instead, the transcript was loaded into a separate electronic system that is otherwise used to store and handle classified information of an especially sensitive nature. One White House official described this act as an abuse of this electronic system because the call did not contain anything remotely sensitive from a national security perspective. Later on in this complaint, they say that while it didn't include anything that was potentially damaging to national security if it were to come out, and thus it's really bizarre that you're putting it in this like especially hidden away server, there were things that were politically damaging. And in fact, this was not the first time that they had used this hidden server to hide the details of calls that were not damaging to national security, but damaging to Donald Trump personally. So let's just take 1 second to acknowledge that the president, who has not stopped talking about Hillary Clinton's hidden server for years now, in fact brought it up on that call with the president of Ukraine, is now using a hidden secure server to hide his telephone calls because he doesn't want you to find out about it, because he and the people around him know exactly how bad it looks. So that's a little extra layer of irony on top of everything that we're dealing with right now. Now in terms of the pressure, the pushing that we heard about yesterday, that seems to have been pretty clear at the time. During the same time frame, around the time frame of the phone call, multiple US officials told me that the Ukrainian leadership was led to believe that a meeting or phone call between the president and President Zelensky would depend on whether Zelensky showed willingness to play ball on the issues that had been publicly aired by Mr. Lutsenko, that's the investigator, and Mr. Giuliani. So they don't know exactly how it was that they got that understanding, but it was apparently common knowledge. And a transition advisor for Zelensky from the time says, no, they understood there were not going to be talks with the United States. There wasn't going to be cooperation or aid from the United States unless they made clear as a prerequisite that they were going to work on these issues of corruption. And I'm going to give some advice to future despots. If you want to hide your activities under the guise of supposedly being worried about corruption, first of all, don't work hand in hand with some of the most corrupt regimes around the world, selling billions of dollars of weapons to the Saudi Arabian government, being close friends with Duterte. These are some of the most corrupt people in the world entirely. But also, if you're gonna have that phone call and bring up corruption, try to come up with at least one instance of it that does not work to your personal political gain. The only corruption he talks about, Donald Trump, who apparently now his number one interest is Ukrainian government corruption, is the CrowdStrike server and Joe Biden. Personal interests of Donald Trump, not issues of concern to the United States. So it's a little bit see-through in that particular way. There's another section, sort of the same idea, but I want you to know that this is something that was very much out there at the time. Donald Trump expressed his conviction that the new Ukrainian government will be able to quickly improve Ukraine's image and this is underscored, complete the investigation of corruption cases that have held back cooperation between Ukraine and the United States. So if the "I need you to do me a favor" though wasn't a clear enough quid pro quo, the understanding at the time on both the US side and the Ukrainian side was, this is holding back cooperation. You need to work on these corruption issues that are all to my personal political benefit if you want cooperation between them and us. There's another section, we don't have time to go into it, but talking about how unprecedented it was that Donald Trump unilaterally, entirely of his own will, shut off the legally provided aid to Ukraine in advance of this telephone call. That weirded out even people inside of the executive branch at the time. But you're gonna hear a lot, obviously, about this whistleblower account. Just the important things to bear in mind. Rudy Giuliani is involved, obviously, we knew that. But now William Barr is as well. They went to seemingly unprecedented efforts to try to hide this information, specifically because they knew exactly how bad it looked. Don't get fooled by the talking points you hear on Fox News. And it was very clear at the time on both sides, Ukraine and the US, that if they wanted military hardware, if they wanted assistance and foreign aid, they were going to have to work on these very particular, very specific cases that Donald Trump wanted dealt with, and dealt with quickly since the primary is rapidly proceeding. All of this is obviously horrible. We'll see what the Dems actually do about it. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Michael Burks is gonna join us. We're gonna be talking a little bit more about impeachment, but also the primary. What should Bernie Sanders do if he wants to take number one after this?
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Less than 48 hours into the process of impeachment for President Trump, reports from inside of the White House say that Trump is actually happy about this, that he's excited about the prospect of defending himself from this inquiry. But is that actually true? Joining us now to discuss this and other important news of the day, Michael Brooks, host of The Michael Brooks Show. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Great to be talking with you as always.
Great to have you here and on a pretty big news day. So Donald Trump, does he actually relish being able to run against the Democrats pushing this impeachment inquiry? What do you think?
Well, I mean, with him, it literally depends on the minute or the hour. Mm-hmm. So I could totally see him being in a mood upswing and being incredibly excited to do this. I think there's only two things about this that are really clear to me politically, setting everything else aside. One that's negative and one that's positive. I do think that this is a fun thing for Trump to run against. And I think he would rile his base and mobilize his base regardless. Mm-hmm. But I do think that this will suck up oxygen. And this is exactly the type of drama that he thrives in some ways, especially if the Democrats don't handle it properly, which they're Democrats. So that's highly likely. The second thing is, on the other hand, what's positive is this will suck up a huge amount of oxygen. And that means less energy for these disgusting, grotesque, evil people in this White House to do more things. They literally are gonna be fighting, if they do it properly, for this process every step of the way, plus a campaign that slows down, at least to some degree, the daily rate of destruction. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think earlier on, like a year and a half ago, we saw a similar sort of effect during the Russia investigation. Now, obviously, that isn't a reason to do these investigations, but if it stops him from doing some of his destructive acts, that's a nice little side effect. I share your concern about the Democrats. Even the way that this was begun doesn't necessarily fill me with a lot of confidence. So I'm curious, you obviously are worried that the Dems might bungle this. What are some ways that they could do that?
Well, I think there's a number of different dynamics, but I mean, the most simple, right before we went on, apparently Nancy Pelosi's always already talking about an incredibly narrow set of inquiries. That's a huge problem. And I think, frankly, too, because this is both my politics and actually what I think plays better. I think, to be honest, like a lot of the kind of smelling salts, oh my God, how could he, of the kind of liberal resistance. I think part of the reason it doesn't resonate with a lot of people is I think a lot of people already have the very clear understanding that there are two-tier and multiple justice systems in this country, and that there's a totally different set of rules for those in power. And by the way, not just Trump. I mean, you know, he is an exaggeration of the norm, but he's not the norm. So I think, you know, if you opened it to more kind of rank stories of corruption, obviously I'm interested in, and this isn't going to happen, but I mean, the guy should be impeached for aiding and abetting a genocide in Yemen for terrorizing children and being a kidnapper, these types of things. If they play it like another, because this is the thing that happened with Russia, right? I think people on both sides of it still overplay it. There's a little bit something fishy there, but also obviously people way exaggerated the depths of it. But there was so much like Lucy in a football, and you could say, yes, it hurt him in some ways. There was some war of attrition, but it also had some negative effects from national security and media and Democratic Party standpoint. But at the end of the day, I felt like after the Mueller hearings, people had to explain why it was bad for him. And you know, you don't want to be in the business of explaining why you won, right? Yeah. Like, so if it gets into that kind of mix up where it's like, no, this is actually really bad, you know, we'll see. I think it needs to be broader and much more aggressive.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if this is what I would have launched the inquiry off of. I think that there have been a lot of other things. I do think though, if there were to be consequences, you point out Yemen, if there were to be consequences for an American president, if he pursues a foreign policy that gets thousands of people killed unnecessarily, then that could conceivably hit other presidents.
Oh, well, exactly.
We can't have that happen.
We can't have that happen. I mean, David Feldman had a great joke that Nancy Pelosi didn't want to impeach Donald Trump, but when he crossed the Rubicon and threatened the children of Democratic politicians making six-figure salaries lobbying for foreign governments, he crossed the line.
Yeah, and not because Hunter Biden had cholera and had been starving to death over the course of weeks or months, but just because of, you know, the investigation. That's a great point. And again, as I always try to credit to a number of different lawmakers on the issue of Yemen, but Bernie Sanders for helping lead the effort to invoke the War Powers Act in that. He was stopped, unfortunately, by the man being impeached right now, but he did do a good job in attempting to do that. And why don't we actually transition over to that? Because I've been really interested in talking to you about the state of the primary as it stands right now in both national polls and some of the early state polls, although not all of them. It looks like we still have the same top three candidates, but Elizabeth Warren is at least tied with Biden, if not ahead in some of these. And so look, I make very clear that I am a supporter of Bernie Sanders. I don't want to speak for you, but that seems pretty clear as well. From the point of view of a person who supports Bernie Sanders, what is the strategy right now? We're still early in this process, but how does he get back into second, get into first? What does he do from here?
Yeah, the only person I would vote over Bernie Sanders would be President Lula, which is certainly a reference people would understand if they follow my work.
That is true.
Well, I think there's a couple of different things that need to happen. One, I do think, you know, and this is a really simple job. This shouldn't be overly complicated, right? It's a mistake to say that Elizabeth Warren is the same thing as Hillary Clinton. She's absolutely not, and that's a weak, foolish line of attack. However, there's a huge amount of people suggesting that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are the same thing.
Yes.
They're not remotely. And if you have an actual left agenda that talks about housing everybody, giving everybody healthcare, complete debt cancellations from medical and student, Bernie Sanders is your choice, and we can't play games anymore. There's a clear progressive choice here. So you either need to sort of acknowledge that that's not your politics, where you're coming from, but don't gaslight and don't obscure those differences. Another huge difference that I think we need to really point to, and obviously, you know, I'm someone who talks a lot about foreign policy, but seriously, look, Sanders does have a much more compelling theory of change. It's not gonna happen institutionally. Any of these plans will happen through a movement. No question. We know that. We know that from the Obama era. But even before we get to that argument, what does a president have power over on day one as soon as they get into office? Without question, foreign policy. Mm-hmm. That's something they actually have the immediate huge influence over. A lot of Americans don't care, but they need to care. One, it's the right thing to care about. And two, it actually does affect us in a myriad of ways. And I would just say that actually, while domestically it's foolish to draw those comparisons with Warren, foreign policy, she is a Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. She has an incredibly conventional, her questionnaire for the Council on Foreign Relations that she just put out on Venezuela, even the way she talked about the Iran deal was awful. She talked about holding the Iranians accountable. Well, excuse me, I have many criticisms of the Iranian government. The United States destroyed that deal.
Yes.
And she voted for Iran sanctions. So this is somebody with a terrible, very conventional view of foreign policy, which is not good enough. I mean, that is a clear area where there's huge stakes here. You're talking millions of people's lives, which you would have a radical improvement on day one without question. So I think the media needs to be clear about it. I think we can't play these false equivalencies. It doesn't mean we need to have silly attacks, but we cannot pretend that there aren't vast gulfs, clear distinctions here that will affect tens of millions of lives in a positive way for Sanders and in not nearly as positive a way for Warren, and in some cases in foreign policy, a negative way. I think Bernie should actually take an overseas trip. I think he should do some things like that that look a little bit more formally presidential.
Which Obama did. Back during that campaign. I couldn't agree more. I think one of the reasons that hasn't become a bigger part of the campaign is in the debate so far, there's virtually no foreign policy at all, very little anyway. The CFR results, that could help people to understand the differences there. And I agree, both in terms of policy, we've done a lot of contrasts of policy between the two on this show, but also in terms of philosophy, their philosophy of movements and of revolutions and how they actually happen. Very different, I agree with you. She's not Hillary Clinton, she's certainly not worse than Donald Trump, but there are differences there. So what I'm curious, in terms of Bernie's strategy, I know that there is an increasing number of Bernie Sanders supporters that want him to rhetorically punch her in the face, to be much more aggressive than he's being. I personally don't see him doing that. Do you think that turn might come, and should it come for Bernie?
I think honestly, some of it really is our job. To some extent, there's some things, and I think it also is important to be really clear that the deck is embarrassingly stacked against Bernie. Mm-hmm. In a way that, even people that oppose him should be sort of taking a few steps back from embarrassing themselves and from actually pushing some much more destructive and pernicious myths. There's a great piece that just dropped in the New Republic by Adolf Reed Jr., who's really one of the most important and legendary academics in the country, called the myth of economic reductionism. And he really talks about the extraordinarily cynical versions of arguments deployed by Democrats to argue against things like single payer and the real ahistoricity and dishonesty of it. I think that, we need to hold people accountable because Bernie obviously gets it on all sides. I think from a campaign perspective, I don't necessarily know, I don't think he needs to turn to Elizabeth Warren and give her, give her a swing like that. But I think as it comes out, as it continues, it has to be like, I think he can kind of with a twinkle in his eye, flip some of the question he asked back to, she asked the John Delaney so well, ask her, why are you running? Why not get rid of all student deficit? Why not get rid of all medical deficit? Why not do something about, the global, the military and industrial complex, not in terms of rebranding it or greening it, but actually scaling it back? I think that he could do that, and we need to be in the position because, he could, Bernie could go to a debate and say, I respectfully disagree with my friend Senator Warren. And, people go, oh my God, what a monster. That's the phase of that. We're already in the disingenuity phase of the anti-Sanders campaign. So I think, we need to run interference. Although I wonder sometimes the lies and the hyperbole, the dishonesty and the melodrama about him is so extreme. I wonder if some of that is a little bit self-negating, because I think that normal people look at it, and even if they're not sold on Sanders, they're kind of like, I don't know, he sort of seems like a nice old man who's trying to raise people's wages, like not somebody who's eating babies. Like, why are you people so weird? what are you talking about?
That's entirely possible. I think for the people who want him to go way more aggressive, I think prepare to be disappointed. He's been friends with her for a long time. He obviously likes his working relationship with her. You're not supposed to say this, but hypothetically, if she did win this, he's definitely going to endorse her and work to get her elected. That's a long way off and certainly not guaranteed, but—
Can I just add one thing to that though, John?
What's real that? Quick?
I think that that is totally true. And I think actually a strategy that I don't know how they do that might actually be helpful though, is because she's also made a lot of emphasis of their friendship and collegiality as well. And I think that's where you start saying to Senator Warren and the Warren campaign, and you see this in the debates, where they are sort of coalescing. You have to say, look, there's a million articles that are praising you because you've been getting glowing press coverages for months. Mm-hmm. And in those same articles, there's constant lies and smears of Bernie Sanders. How about you, in the same way that he's not sharpening the real distinctions with you, why don't you step out and say, hey, you know, supporting my campaign is not predicated on lying about Bernie Sanders and his supporters. That's some heat the Warren campaign should feel. Yeah.
That is a very good point, Michael. I really like that. I know that we're over, but I really like talking to you about this. So I have one more topic for you, one more question. So please, as I alluded to earlier, Biden has been slipping. He's been eclipsed in some of the polls by Warren. I think a lot of people have sort of written him off, like assuming that eventually he will drop off. Do you feel like we're at the point where we can safely say that, or is there a road that he rides back to number one?
He's still arguably number one right now. Yeah. I mean, I've been.
So you're not writing right off.
Never. And I said, I think I actually said on your show, I was there the day of his dreary announcement, and you, Anna, and myself had great commentaries on it. But I was just saying, like, especially in our circles and the audiences we talk to, nobody's into this guy. If you open the aperture out, like I was talking to my friend and colleague, Artesia Balthrop, she's like, yeah, my mom loves Joe Biden. I mean, this guy is not out. And I have to say, to be honest with you, I'm a little bit scared, because I was saying he's stronger than we would think several months ago. He's had a pretty rough ride of it in terms of his performance of the debates and stuff. And he's still polling really well. So I actually would say, I mean, look, he's super vulnerable, and I still think we can get Sanders through. That's where I'm at. But I think talk of Biden's demise, I'm sad to say, I think are really premature.
Okay, I think you might be right. So something to bear in mind, there's multiple battles to be fought simultaneously. Michael, as always, great to talk to you. People should definitely check out, if they haven't already, and they probably have, The Michael Brooks Show. Thank you as always.
I really appreciate it. Thanks, man.
Thanks. We're gonna take a short break here, more after this. We all get that there's biased media out there, and Fox and Friends might be about as biased as it comes. But sometimes the news is so obvious that it simply has to be addressed. You can't dodge it. And so I want to give credit to Fox and Friends this morning for sticking to the most important issues.
It's unbelievable. It's supposed to be Janice introduces gluten-free international House of Pancakes Day.
But you told us, you gave us all of the history of it. I thought, you know, it's time for me to eat.
Right. So Brian, take it away.
Well, I will say a few things.
What when else
I
go into IHOP,
I'm always amazed. I'm always amazed about the way we're coming up with different ways of flavoring syrup. I mean, just you thought this a lot of sugar and sap and just putting a funnel in a tree was enough.
This
but
is
now
fashion.
There's blueberries.
I cannot taste the difference.
I'm always amazed at the different ways we come up to flavor syrup. I thought you just stuck a needle in a tree and threw some sugar at it, but now there's blueberry. I don't think blueberry is a new innovation. I think that they've had those. I'm pretty sure IHOP has had that since I was a child. He's the dumbest person on TV. He makes Steve Ducey look like an intelligent person, and he makes so much money. So that's what you'll get for Fox and Friends. That's what Donald Trump is watching and probably developing a craving for IHOP right now. So this is one strategy on Fox News. When the news is so obviously bad for the president, just bring on the flapjacks. So that's one way you can go. The other way, you might be forced into a fight, an internal fight to Fox News, as a result of Shep Smith having a guest on that simply acknowledged what seems clear, that Donald Trump appears to have committed a crime. So Shep Smith had that. He's, you know, a host on Fox. And so another host on Fox, who's a much bigger defender of the president, wasn't gonna stand by and let that happen.
Yesterday, Judge Andrew Napolitano, who is a legal analyst at Fox and a very nice guy, I will say, I've always liked him, went on one of our daytime shows and declared that the president's phone call with the head of Ukraine was a crime. Well, apparently our daytime host, who hosted Judge Napolitano, was watching last night and was outraged by what you said and, quite ironically, called you partisan. Here's what he said.
A partisan guest who supports President Trump was asked about Judge Napolitano's legal assessment. And when he was asked, he said, unchallenged, Judge Napolitano is a fool. Attacking our colleague, who's here to offer legal assessments on our air, in our work home, is repugnant.
repugnant. Not clear if that was you or me, but someone's repugnant. Now, unlike maybe some dayside hosts, I'm not very partisan, and it was a sincere question. Is it a crime or not? So given everything that's happened in the last 24 hours, I just want to throw it to you again. Was it a crime or not?
Absolutely not.
People of goodwill have differing views.
Yes.
And so that's why it doesn't seem honest to me when a host, any host on any channel, including this one, pretends that the answer is obvious. There is an ironclad consensus about what the answer is, when there in fact isn't. Wouldn't it be better if we just said out loud, you know, this is what I think. And I'll just say, for example, you'll never hear me criticize Rachel Maddow.
There were like five examples there of why I'm so frustrated every time someone like twists themselves in a mental pretzel to try to normalize Tucker Carlson or pretend that he's some sort of free thinker. First of all, he claimed there, I'm not really partisan at all. You know, I only will support literally every Republican president for the entirety of my life in lockstep. I can say whatever I want about supposedly my interest in populism or, you know, helping out people, questioning the elites and all that. I will support every Republican until the day I die. So that's the nonpartisan Tucker Carlson. I love him weirdly not being willing to name Shep Smith. And he keeps mocking the fact that he's a daytime host. He keeps saying the daytime hosts here may think something. But then there's, of course, the gigantic logical gaps there. So he attacks Shep Smith for having a guest on who implies that Trump has committed a crime. Tucker's issue with that is that that is Shep Smith being dishonest. So it's ridiculous to claim that this is a clear, like an open and shut thing to be able to say that it is a crime. And it is embarrassing for Shep Smith to have a guest come on and say that, because secretly Shep Smith wants to say that, but he won't actually admit how partisan he is. So what does Tucker Carlson do? He says he's not partisan, brings on a guest who says it's absolutely not a crime, implying that it's an open and shut thing. And he does that to hide the fact that obviously he doesn't think that it's a crime. He is in the middle of like a 1 minute period of video doing everything he is claiming that Shep Smith is doing, and doing it with a stupid grin on his face because he thinks he's outsmarted people. Now he's mostly right, he's outsmarted his audience. They're not gonna catch on to any of this, but it is obviously ridiculous on its face. And it's interesting to see Fox, as this story develops, start to feud with each other. I don't know how many others are gonna come out and sort of acknowledge reality, but Shep Smith, he can reliably be expected to do that. Juan Williams on The Five yesterday, so he acknowledged that White House talking points seemed to be going around. He didn't even say that Fox was doing it. He certainly didn't say that The Five was doing it. But go find that video. Jordan Ewell tweeted it out. The whole place explodes over that accusation. Greg Gutfeld like sits back and crosses arms, say, did you read that on Media Matters? Because they know what they're doing. They got those talking points, and maybe they already agreed with most of them. Maybe they would have said them even without them. But they're definitely spreading the talking points that the White House wants them to, and they don't like to their face being accused of doing that. So this is certainly gonna be a show to watch as the story develops. We'll have more in the future. We are gonna take a short break. We come back, Tom Hartman joins the show. The Supreme Court obviously has an incredible amount of power, but should it? Must it? Or is it time for reform? Joining us now to discuss his upcoming book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America, New York Times bestselling author and host of the Tom Hartman program. Tom Hartman, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John, great to see you again.
Great to have you here. I found your book really interesting, A History of the Supreme Court, and specifically talking about some of the biggest issues with it. But I guess I should let you explain what's the focus of the book this time around.
Well, there were a couple of big stories that I wanted people to get. The first is that the court has, particularly over the last 60 years or so, become an extremely political instrument. It's not the apolitical, we're just calling balls and strikes that they try to pretend they are, particularly when you throw in this this made up fantasy that Robert Bork came up with of originalism, that we can read the minds of the founders, just like, you know, Jimmy Swagger tells you he can read God's mind. It's just as much of a scam. Secondly, that the Supreme Court has taken power to itself that the framers and founders never intended for it to have, or at least many of them never intended for it to have. And that has distorted our politics and our law in substantial ways. And the third is that Congress has a set of powers to basically control and, to use the language of the Constitution, regulate and provide exceptions to what the Supreme Court can do. that Congress has virtually never used and really should seriously consider using. And so, you know, those are kind of the three big takeaways.
So let's talk about one of the big powers, and you were sort of alluding to this earlier, that is judicial review. What should people know about this incredibly powerful, basically power that the Supreme Court gave itself?
Yeah, it did. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court can strike down a law by saying that that law violates the Constitution. The Constitution does not establish the Supreme Court as an arbiter of itself. It's very explicit and specific about what the Supreme Court can do. You know, they're the first court of jurisdiction when it comes to international disputes, the first court of jurisdiction in debates or disputes between and among the states. But that when it comes to regular law, that they are simply the final court of appeals. That, you know, you sue somebody and then they counter sue and, you know, goes back and forth and back and forth. And eventually it has, the buck has to stop somewhere. And that's what the Supreme Court was from you know, 1789 right up until 1803, when in the Marbury versus Madison decision, the Supreme Court decided that they also had the power to strike down laws, saying that the supreme law of the land was the Constitution, and they were its arbiters, and therefore every other law had to be filtered through their understanding of what the Constitution meant. This so flipped out President Thomas Jefferson that he just went nuts. He went on a rampage. He said, you know, under this doctrine, the Constitution has become a thing of wax. He said, it's become a complete fin de se. He wrote in a letter to Abigail Adams, as I recall. Fin de se is Latin for a suicide pact. He said, this makes it, in another letter to, I'm forgetting who it was, but in any case, another letter, I think it might've been to Madison. He said, this, you know, under this doctrine, this makes the judiciary the most despotic branch. And it so, you know, created a huge controversy in the United States. And the outcome of that was that the court backed off. John Marshall never did that again. He was the longest serving Supreme Court justice in history, and he never did that again. It wasn't until 1856 when the Supreme Court Justice Roger Taney decided that he was going to once and for all settle the slavery problem. And in the Dred Scott decision ruled that all people of color in the United States could be bought and sold, period, full stop. And that, of course, led us right into the Civil War. And famously, Abraham Lincoln said, you know, I'm not going to do what the Supreme Court said.
Yeah.
But that's now that's pretty much all they do.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you do a great job in the book in making the case for how the Supreme Court has almost always sided with the powerful and the wealthy, using that power and others. What are some examples that you'd like to point out that were most consequential in that area?
Well, the court has over the, I don't know how many years it is, nearly 90 years, I guess, since the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, legalized unions. There were a few years there when they were on the side of unions, but starting in the 50s, really in a big way, they just started taking apart union power. And they've continued doing that right up to this day. They defend corporations over people regularly. They have always been the very last to defend civil rights on the occasions that they have. And most recently, you know, John Roberts famously gutting the Voting Rights Act, which has led to, you know, massive voter disenfranchisement. The list is long, John. It's a long list.
And look, I know looking forward, a lot of people are worried that even if 2020 leaves us with a progressive in the White House, Donald Trump's appointments to the Supreme Court have left in a position where it might spend the next 2 or 4 or 8 years overturning key pieces of legislation. And so I know some people are thinking about the possibility of changing that in a number of different ways. One hypothetically coming from this book is reforms to change the status of judicial review, their ability to overturn legislation. How likely would you say that is to happen?
I think that's the least likely. I titled that chapter, and it was based on a memo that John Roberts wrote when he was working for Ronald Reagan, in which he was talking about how they could overturn the Roe v. Wade decision of 73 and the Brown v. Board of 54, how they could overturn those two decisions without having to run through the court and without having to do a constitutional amendment. And he pointed out that Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution gives Congress the power to regulate the court and to provide exceptions to what it can rule on. So Congress could literally pass a law saying, states have to comply with the Voting Rights Act. And by the way, the Supreme Court may not review this. Mm-hmm. It would provoke a constitutional crisis because it's not been done before. But that power is explicit in the Constitution. And that's what John Roberts pointed out. Reagan didn't go for it. I don't think he ever thought that he had a large enough majority to be able to pull it off. But that would be one way to control the court. The other is court packing. And we've seen political court packing. Franklin Roosevelt nearly did this in 37. And it was quite popular. The court had struck down child labor laws as unconstitutional. They had struck down long-term unemployment payments. They had struck down parts of the right to unionize. They had struck down, just a whole bunch of good progressive legislation. And they were fixing to strike down Social Security as unconstitutional in that court session. And it turns out, Roosevelt said, okay, we're going to make every justice over 70 be a justice emeritus, and they don't have a vote anymore. Or in aggregate, there were five of them at that time. In aggregate, they have one vote, and then we'll put four new people on the court to fill it out. He ultimately didn't have to do that because Francis Perkins had a conversation, his Secretary of Labor had a conversation with the wife of Justice Owens, and basically convinced her to convince him to change his vote, which he did. And that was the end of that. But Roosevelt had a lot of popular support for that. Another one is after the Civil War, when Andrew Johnson became president, there was a vacancy on the court at that time that happened right around the time he became president. And the Congress, hated Johnson. I mean, that's why they impeached him. He was a slave owner. He was nakedly, sympathetic to the South. And so they passed a law within a week or so of his becoming president that reduced the number of members of the court from 7 to 6 so that he couldn't put anybody else on the court. Mm-hmm. And then, about a month after he left office and U.S. Grant became president, they passed another law raising the number of justices back up to 7. So, and that was very popular also. So there's a bunch of ways to get around the court. It's just been a long time since anybody seriously tried to do it.
Well, we might be entering a period where that sort of thing could be considered. The Supreme Court obviously not closely aligned with the interests of the American people in a number of important issues that are likely to face big legislative pushes over the next few years. So in advance of that, I think that people should definitely take a look at your book and get an idea of the history of this, where it might go from here. The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. I believe it's available October 1st, Tom?
Yeah, it ships October 1st. You can buy it on online bookstores now, and you can put in a reservation in your local bookstore too.
Awesome. Tom Hartman, thank you as always for joining us.
Thanks so much, John. Great talking with you again.
Good talking to you as always. We're going to take a short break. Be back after this. It isn't just right-wing media that's trying to figure out how exactly they're supposed to play this thing. As more and more details come out about Trump and what he did, what message are they supposed to be sending? The New York Times is also getting itself in some hot water. Put out an article today. Now, whether it intended to or not, and I happen to think it kind of did, it is being used, this article, to imply that swing voters are already done with this impeachment thing. They're not interested. They're sticking by the president, I guess. They've got anxiety. The article makes a reference to a bunch of different emotions they're experiencing. But here is the con that is being played. While you can go on Twitter right now and search six swing voters. That's who they supposedly talk to. I want to give you an idea of who these swing voters are. So we've got Trisha Hope, who has been to 23 Make America Great Again rallies around the country and compiled a collection of Mr. Trump's tweets in a book. She said that she saw nothing improper in the publicly released version of the call and that the formal move towards impeachment had strengthened her support. Well, that is fascinating. Someone who's been to 23 Trump rallies, who is at Trump rallies with a booth selling a book of Trump tweets. She doesn't think he did anything wrong. That is fascinating. Thank you, The New York Times, for tracking down this swing voter, an independent who could have gone either way in 2020. You've also got a quote from Reggie Dickerson, 54-year-old pipe fitter and timber worker who lives in Eastern Kentucky. Sounds like the stereotypical person you'd want to talk to on something like this. He says, I think it's an absolute joke, the whole thing, which is totally his right to think that this whole thing is a joke. You should understand, though, before you decide that he is just some independent swing voter, he has been interviewed multiple times by the New York Times. Many of these people have. They keep going back to the same Trump supporters. Here is a photo from one of those articles. And so you can see him and what looks like a delightful Christmas tree and a framed portrait of Robert E. Lee. So maybe not a total independent who could go either way on Donald Trump or on the Republican Party. I think he might be predisposed to listen to what the president has to say. The whole thing is ridiculous. We don't know at this point where the public will come down on impeachment. I can say that at this point, they're already more supportive than they were back during the Nixon years. You can look at the comparison of those polls. And you can also see that the public opinion switched very quickly with Richard Nixon. That won't necessarily happen here, but we have to wait and find out. Okay, buddy, thank you for watching. If you're not a member, become one. We've got more content coming on the other side of this. There's a lot of news going on here in the US, but it turns out things continue to develop abroad. And that's why it's time for Meanwhile In. Meanwhile in China, footage has been released, apparently anonymously released drone footage of blindfolded prisoners being moved potentially to a re-education camp. Take a look at this footage. You're gonna see these people who have their hands tied behind their backs. They are blindfolded. Obviously incredibly dehumanizing, a huge group of people. Different bits of information, contextual information have been put together. And the idea, we have a pretty good idea of what's happening here. So the video, which was anonymously posted on YouTube last week, shows what appears to be Uyghur or other minorities wearing blue and yellow uniforms with cleanly shaven heads, their eyes covered, sitting in rows on the ground and later being led away by police. It's believed, because we don't know for sure, much, but we believe that the area that it came out is Xinjiang. And that is one of the hot zones for the re-education camps that a lot of people have been incredibly and rightfully critical of in China over the past few years. According to analysis by the New York Times, local courts sentenced 230,000 people to prison or other punishments from 2017 to 2018 as this campaign to, depending on who you're listening to, either re-educate or disappear people that the regime is not big fans of, or simply, you know, fight against terrorism if you believe the official line from the government. In that region, that's 2% of the country's population, but accounts for about 21% of all arrests. So obviously, incredibly disproportionate there. Now, China contends that its state-mandated detention camps, surrounded by high walls and watchtowers, are central to its fight against Islamist extremism. Beijing has called them boarding schools, explaining detainees are there voluntarily. China said recently that it has reduced the number in the camps, though doubts persist about the claims. And we're talking about very large numbers of people. The UN has previously said at least 1 million Uyghurs alone are involved there. Many people, by the way, consider that to be an undercount, a significant one. And the conditions in these camps are about what you would expect. This is a story that you don't hear too much reporting about, partially because it's so difficult to actually get information, partially because out of sight, out of mind. My small, I think fairly simple request would be do a little bit of reading about this. It is a horrendous story that continues to develop. It should not be ignored just because we might not have a government that wants to actually take any sort of hard line on human rights abuses in China. Meanwhile, in Brazil, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is at the UN and he is talking about the Amazon in a way that will likely blow your mind and probably enrage you. So here's a section of what he said. First of all, my government is solemnly committed to environmental preservation and sustainable development to the benefit of Brazil and the world. All countries have their issues. However, the sensationalist attacks we have suffered from much of the international media due to the Amazon fires have aroused our patriotic sentiment. With a guy whose history Jair Bolsonaro has, I don't want to hear anything about his patriotic sentiment being aroused. I know what sorts of policies that leads to. He goes on to say, it's a misconception to state that the Amazon is a world heritage. And it is a misconception, as scientists attest, to say that the forest is the lung of the world. Resorting to these fallacies, some countries, instead of helping, have followed the lies of the media and behaved disrespectfully with a colonialist spirit. That is hilarious, absurd, insane. not only was a huge amount of damage done to the Amazon, and it is critically important. I don't care what someone like him, who's purely thinking about this from economic terms, what he happens to think about it. The idea that international attention on a crucial area of the world being burned down before our very eyes, that is some sort of colonialist attack against Brazil, as he is pushing to move in and take out indigenous people through whatever means necessary to exploit that area for economic development, that is, as they would say, rich. But he goes on to say, they have questioned what is most sacred to us, our sovereignty. And so look, people who are working in the area, obviously they're not big fans of this speech, think it's ridiculous and are speaking out against it. We've got public policy coordinator of Greenpeace Brazil who said, Bolsonaro is trying to convince the world that he is protecting the Amazon when in reality he is promoting the dismantlement of the environment. Under his management, burning, deforestation, and violence have increased outrageously. For the forest and its people, Bolsonaro is a problem, not the solution. And although I think that having a concern about the Amazon is certainly enough by itself, that is not the only concern here, as I alluded to earlier. Bolsonaro also said, unfortunately, some people, both inside and outside Brazil, with the support of NGOs, insist on treating and keeping our natives as cavemen. So that is not international NGOs just saying they must be cavemen. That is indigenous groups that do not want to be rooted out, either move to a different area. Potentially there's some deaths as well, some imprisonments. That is an argument that is meant to precipitate government action against the indigenous people of that region of the world. That's all it is. He can try to deflect things with colonial spirit this and care for the environment that. But this is the initial call that tells you that massive human rights abuses are coming. So don't be surprised when it comes if nobody stops it. He is announcing it loud and clear as we speak. Okay, that's unfortunately all the time we have. Thank you so much for watching. We have only one day remaining, but big news to get to. Brett Ehrlich is going to join us on Friday's show. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Derola. I'll see you soon.